Right, I rolled out the red carpet, the, all of the Jewish Historical Society of South Carolina and the greater Orangeburg area, and we're just thrilled to be here. I want to tell you a little bit about the Jewish Historical Society of South Carolina. We're the largest statewide Jewish organization in South Carolina, and we meet biannually in different locations around the state. The Society publishes a newsletter twice a year and sponsors meetings in different locations throughout the state with nationally renowned speakers on a multitude of topics. Most recently, we had one in Columbia yesterday, and before that we were in Aiken, where they actually unveiled a historical marker in Aiken, South Carolina as well. And that's just many of the places, like Ernie had said earlier today at the marker ceremony. We have markers down recently in Anderson, South Carolina, of course, and in Aiken, and Buford, South Carolina, just had one recently, and now here in Orangeburg, and we're thrilled. Most of these markers, when they're actually all of them, are usually 100 years old or older, the community. Because this is happening, so if we don't do this, then it doesn't get preserved. And so I'm thrilled to be here, and I'm thrilled to welcome you from the bottom of our heart to the Jewish Historical Society of South Carolina. And without further ado, Ernie, what's the next?
I'm just going to say something to David Farr. Where is David? David's up back there.
David's up here the other day.
Yeah. I just wanted to say how much we appreciate everything that our Temple Sinai has done. David Farr, from the very beginning, has really championed us coming here. And there's not a lot of members at Temple Sinai, and it was a lot to do. It was really a lot more on his shoulders, so I'm going to say thanks.
Well, as of now, you know who I am, but I won't introduce myself. But as president of Temple Sinai, we're proud to welcome the attendees of the Jewish Historical Society of South Carolina's Fall Conference, A Tale of Two Cities and a Few Small Towns, members of our temple and members of the broader Orangeburg community. And also, we're fortunate to have several here who are family members of the founders of this temple, which marks 60 years of being in existence in Orangeburg this year. Having the marker placed downtown is a wonderful acknowledgement of the rich history of Jewish life in Orangeburg, both businesses and the social life of the community. By the latter part of the 20th century, that history was nearly gone. I want to tell you a bit about today's community, and in particular, Temple Sinai. The first Jewish congregation in Orangeburg was the Rif Shalom, established in 1918, it appears that it was classical reform. Many of the old Orangeburg families attended services in the Sunday school. Families such as Mosley, Cohn, Pershkot, Sorensrud, Mermo, and others. And to add a little bit, much of my information comes from Milton Marcus, who unfortunately is no longer with us. But Milton was a great source of history, and Milton told me on numerous occasions about the Sunday schools which were held in various homes, one of which was his mother's in her living room for a number of years. In the 1950s, Orangeburg Jews organized Temple Sinai. The building in which we are standing was completed in 1956 with seating for 100 members. Downstairs is a social hall, kitchen, and a religious school. Past member families who came to Orangeburg and surrounding small towns include Teske, Rubenstein, Miller, Rich, Marcus, Benjamin, Nussbaum, and many others that we haven't mentioned. Membership appears to have peaked at about 15 to 20 families in the 1950s. Is that correct? We never had our own rabbi, relying instead on visiting rabbis or student rabbis. Our congregation today is small and committed. Total membership is about a dozen members, and we share membership duties. We have Shabbat here once a month and take turns leading services. We've had a bar mitzvah service here about 12 or 15 years ago, maybe back when how far. We've not had any weddings, but occasionally a funeral. We've talked about some type of a relationship with the synagogue in Charleston or Columbia to help us continue as a congregation. We don't feel we're at that point yet, but we're still able to maintain the building and have community functions on a fairly regular basis. We do not know what the future will hold, but we feel an obligation to keep the synagogue alive for future Jewish families. At this time, I'd like to introduce Dale Rosengarten, who is the moderator for today's discussion. Dale Rosengarten is the founding curator of the Jewish Heritage Collection and director of the New Center for Southern Jewish Culture, both at the College of Charleston. She earned her BA and PhD from Harvard University. She's worked with the McKissick Museum and the University of South Carolina. She developed a traveling exhibition, A Portion of the People, 300 Years of Jewish Life, in 2002 and 2003. She co-edited the book by the same name. She is currently co-curating an exhibition titled By Dawn's Early Light, Jewish Contributions to American Culture from the Nation's Founding to the Civil War. Scheduled to open at Princeton University Museum of Art in February 2016. While assembling a distinguished archive from Southern Jewish history and culture for the College of Charleston's Addlestone Library, Dale has continued to pursue her other chief field of interest, the African-American tradition of Koyum basketry. In partnership with the Museum for African Art in New York, she developed the exhibition Grassroots, American Origins of an American Art, in 2008-2010, which had a six-month run at the Smithsonian Institute in Washington, D.C., and co-authored the accompanying volume. I now give the podium to Dale Rosengarten.
Thank you, Mr. Farr, and thank you all for sticking with this very cold day, but I feel warm in here, and there's a beautiful oneg downstairs, so we'll enjoy that. I'm going to ask if Dr. Atkinson will begin with his slideshow. He's going to give you kind of an overview of Jewish heritage in Orangeburg, and then we'll start with our panelists' brief self-introductions, questions, and questions from the audience.
Okay. Give me just a minute to get set up, and my remote's not working, so I'm going to put my chair over here. And I think I'll talk loud enough for everybody to hear me.
Should these people move?
Can we move up some?
Yeah, these people have to move on the panel. Sometimes, you know, all these computer things drive people crazy anymore. Tell you what, the person on the front row right there, can you lean a little bit more to the right?
Irvin, why don't you move over here?
Okay. There we go, thank you. All right. This is Orangeburg's symbolic figure, the old war wheel kind of based on Memorial Garden. And I'm going to talk to you a little bit about the Jewish merchants and famous Jewish people in Orangeburg right now for a few moments. Leopold Lewis is acknowledged to be the first Jewish merchant in Orangeburg. He came penniless as a little boy back in the 1830s. He was born in 1815 and came here in the 1830s and worked real hard and actually was able to open his first store up in the 1840s. And when he died later on, I think in the 1880s, he was the oldest merchant in town at that particular time. But he is the original guy that led to all the other Jewish merchants coming to Orangeburg through the years. This is his home right there. And for Martin and Carol and Rella, that is the corner of Broughton Street and Amelia Street. There used to be an old spur gas station there when we were growing up here in Orangeburg. But that was his home. And he's on the porch standing up with his wife. Immediately in front of him is his son-in-law, Mr. Samuel Bibble, and of course, the Leopold Lewis's daughter is over there with the two sons over there. Anna Christiana is her name. But anyway, Congressman Dibble became a congressman from the United States back in the 1880s, and he was quite an attorney, and also was a leader in education in South Carolina. Theodore Cone, if you remember from where we had the marker a while ago unveiling, across the street was the Theodore Cone building, the way his store was. He was probably the most prominent merchant in town as far as the largest store, the largest department store in Orangeburg. He started in 1868 with Mr. Ezekiel, and after about a year or so, Mr. Ezekiel left, and then his brother, Theodore Cone's brother, Henry Cone, joined him in business, and then later on they parted ways years later. But anyway, Theodore Cone had the largest department store in town, and ladies back in those days used to wear hats for every social occasion, and proper ladies would wear a different hat for every occasion during the day, and somebody had to go through 3 or 4 hat changes a day when they go out in public. Anyway, Mr. Cone, in the back of his department store, had a millinery shop, and he had about 4 or 5 milliners that he would bring down from up north to fabricate these hats for ladies and so forth, and many of them ended up marrying Orangeburg people and settling here. But you don't see a millinery store much anymore. He was also considered to be the father of Orangeburg's great schools when public schools got started in the 1890s here in Orangeburg. And he was quite active in getting the schools established. Here he is on the right there with all the other trustees around 1900. And Martin and Aurel, if you recognize that, that's the old junior high school building here in Orangeburg. It was built in 1894, the first public school built in Orangeburg. We used to have private academies before public education. Here's an interior view of Cone's department store. The slogan was years ago, if you can find it in New York, you can find it at Cone's in Orangeburg. You kept up with the latest styles and everything. And look, see all the ladies' hats there in the foreground? Of 1917 there. And this is his brother, Henry Cone, right here, with the star there. Henry Cone was quite an accomplished cultural person. He loved symphony music. And he and his wife founded the Orangeburg Symphony Orchestra, and many times they played and practiced at his house, and on Sunday afternoons they would have chamber music concerts and so forth like that. He was also one of the premier volunteers with the Young America Volunteer Fire Department, which was the biggest of the volunteer fire departments prior to 1920 when the city took over. But this is an occasion when the firemen got together for a reunion. It was also his 50th wedding anniversary right there. This is Theodore Cone's son, August Cone. He was a publisher, a journalist, and a businessman. Spent most of his adult life in Columbia. He was the bureau chief for the Charleston News and Courier at the State House for many years. And then when the state newspaper was formed in the 1890s or around 1900, he was their chief man at the State House. And he was a businessman. He ran an investment firm. He also did various real estate development. He was also on the Board of Trustees of the University of South Carolina, and he was always in charge of the Finance Committee. And it was said that he was the one that really got most of the buildings started around 1910 or 20 for the expansion and growth at the University of South Carolina. But he grew up here in Orangeburg. This lady right here is Ms. Octavia Moses Jennings. She came here upon a marriage in 1895 to Orangeburg. Her husband was quite a business entrepreneur and owned the Orangeburg Ice and Fuel Plant, the Coca-Cola plant, and later what became the Sunbeam Bakery. And she was quite a humanitarian around town. Her husband was mayor of Orangeburg for 16 years, I think from 1920 to 1936, somewhere around that era. And she did so many good things around the town. She would take orders from people, and they'd order a trainload, boxcar full of shrubbery and so forth for people to beautify their yards in Orangeburg. She was very good about beautifying Orangeburg. She was on the board of the hospital, and before it became a public hospital, when it was a private hospital, she headed up the relief fund, which basically raised money for the indigent's care at the private hospital, the first hospital in Orangeburg. But she was quite a humanitarian. And her son right there, Bob Jennings Jr., became mayor for 12 years in his own right. And Rella and Martin, if you remember, His son, Robert Jennings III, who just died several years ago, was quite a prominent businessman here in town also. Now, this right here, Rutta, is your father's store on the right, Rich's Ladies Clothing Store.
Grandfather's store.
Grandfather's, excuse me, I'm getting my generation mixed up here. And anyway, the business next door was Fagan's Shoe Shop, and apparently had some kind of special grand opening, a clown minstrel show or whatever it is, big thing. And, but anyway, you see Rich's Clothing Store over there on the right. And if you look at the sign in the upper right, it says boarders wanted. The upstairs were apartments where people would board. Had room to board there. That was Lipton Rich Clothing Store. Mr. Eddie Mermo was quite a leader here in Orangeburg. He had a clothing store downtown, and then later on he founded the Mid-State Investment Company. He was probably the biggest sports enthusiast ever in Orangeburg. He would have neighborhood teams before the city had an organized recreation department. And his area was the Moss Heights, and he had the Moss Heights football team, all these kids in the neighborhood, and they play other neighborhoods around town. Called them Moss Heights Marbles, I believe. He also started the first high school booster club in the entire Southeast in the 1940s at Orangeburg High School called the Indian Club, the Orangeburg Indians. And they peaked at about 600 and so members during the prime. Like I said, he just promoted sports. He helped with American League. He put up boys in his house when they come back from an out-of-town game so they wouldn't have to travel far to their house or whatever. And he just was so sports-minded that they named the Mermo Field after him in Orangeburg. Here he is at one of the Indian Club booster things, banquets, and the guest speaker right there standing up was Ed Danforth, who was the sports editor of the Atlanta Journal, who you got to come all the way from Atlanta to do this back in 1948. And this is a picture of Mermo Field that was named after him. It was a classic baseball field from that era, and a movie was made there several years ago. They needed to have a classic baseball field from the 1940s, and they chose Orangeburg because of that. And here he is at age 90, still playing golf. He played golf well into his 90s. He also never missed a Carolina home football game until in his 90s. So he was quite a sports enthusiast. Lester Finkelstein, whose store was right next to where the marker was today, was quite a prominent businessman. Mr. Lester Finkelstein was very forthright. Now, as I told you, the cemetery tour, if I was trying on something, he didn't like the way it looked on me, he'd make me take it off. He said, I'm not going to sell it to you. It doesn't look good on you. He knew clothes. And he was very forthright. He was very opinionated, and he was always right, too. He was one of the last of the Jewish merchants here. Mr. Milton Marcus was the last one in 1996 closed, and I think Mr. Fink closed around 1990 and 91 or 2, somewhere around there. Now, this is a very nostalgic story for me. I want to point out right here, that's Robert Ferschgott, who was on the 1931 football team from Orangeburg High School that won the state championship. Before I go any further on that, the manager in the back right, with an O for Orangeburg, I'm going to say, is Sidney Klein, whose grave I pointed out also earlier during the cemetery tour. But anyway, Robert Ferschgott always wanted to be a scientist. When he graduated from Orangeburg High School, he was voted most handsome and most popular. He fought with his first cousin, Edwin Mosley, to be valedictorian, and he said he won. Edwin Mosley went on to become president of Skidmore College in upstate New York later on. Robert Ferschgott achieved a claim of his own, and he won the Nobel Prize for Medicine for the entire world. And here he is in 1998, receiving the Nobel Prize from the King of Sweden. And it doesn't get any better than this. Grew up in Orangeburg. And here is a pullout of that ceremony. There's the queen on the far right. I think that's the queen mother next to her. And then the king giving Robert Ferschgott the Nobel Prize for Medicine. Isn't that phenomenal? And here's the photo shoot afterwards with he and the other co-recipients. He shared the Nobel Prize for Medicine with two other fellows. And they're posing with the king and queen. And Dr. Ferschgott's wife died about 1981-82, right? And he was in the midst of making all these discoveries that ultimately led to him winning the Nobel Prize. And the lady next to him actually became his common-law wife. They never really got married. And unfortunately, she was suffering from Alzheimer's when this occurred. And you can see how she's violating protocol by holding on to the queen there. She had Alzheimer's and was pretty well advanced at that time. It's really sad, but she was able to go to Stockholm, Sweden for the ceremony. By the way, for those of you who are from Charleston, Dr. Ferschgott, well, his school that he worked at was the Medical Center in Brooklyn, New York. He went through several name changes through the years. But he was always very close to the Medical University of Charleston. And Walton, who was head of the pharmacology department, like he was in Brooklyn, they were best friends, and he'd come down and visit from time to time. And in 1980, Dr. Ferschgott, on sabbatical, spent a year at the Medical University in Charleston, right when he was at the height of doing his research that won the Nobel Prize. So that was phenomenal right there. A lot of his research was done in South Carolina. Here he is with his acceptance speech. The Nobel Prize. And here's a classroom picture of him. Back, he worked until he was age 86 doing research and retired and came to Charleston, which was his boyhood home in his early years. I became great friends with him after he returned to Charleston, and I started talking with him on the phone because I wanted to give him a picture, a copy of that picture of him on the football team from 1931. And he interrupted me and said, "Butch Atkinson was your father?" And I said, "David." He said, "Well, you know, back in 1933, a bunch of us college kids went to the Chicago World's Fair," and says, "your daddy drove the car that I rode in." He says, "Is he still alive?" I said, "No, son, he's dead." He said, "How about your Uncle Bill Atkinson?" I said, "Well, he's still alive, but he's got Alzheimer's and that the Methodist Oaks, Methodist home." He said, "Bill was my best friend in high school and my roommate when we went away to college." He said, "Gene, you got to come down here to Charleston. We got to talk." So anyway, I sent him copies of my first two books, which were Pictorial Histories of Orangeburg, that had that picture of him and the football team. And he called me back the next day in my office, and my receptionist came to me and said, "There's a Dr. Ferschgott on the phone. Can you take the call?" When it's a Nobel Prize winner, you do take the call, I'll tell you that. We became great friends and just had a wonderful friendship through the years. But anyway, after you got the books, that time he called me up, he said, "Gene, I stayed up half of last night looking over your books, and I found a picture of my mother in their book, and I'll show you that picture in just a second. But here he is right before he left Charleston when he had to go to assisted living where one of his daughters was living in Seattle. We got the mayor here to give him the key to the city of Orangeburg, and I went down to Charleston and presented it to him before he left, and he was most appreciative of that. But anyway, he was just shy of his 92nd birthday in this picture. Here's his mother in the 1902 Queen's Court and the Fall Festival here in Orangeburg, which is a precursor to the county fair. And his mother was one of the beauties in the Queen's Court. This picture does not show the king in there, but the king was none other than my grandfather, Gene Atkinson, for whom I'm named after. My family's crossed paths again. So we had a wonderful friendship. And he called me up about 3 weeks before he died from Seattle. And I didn't know he was in bad health at that time. And said, "Gene, I'm just going over some of my things. And I've got my memory book from Orangeburg High School." And nowadays, we had yearbooks with pictures and stuff. They didn't have that back then. They had these memory books, that purple mimeograph stuff. And it was about 20 pages long. He said, "Would you like to have it since you collect history of Orangeburg?" I said, "Yes, sir, I would." He had his daughter mail it to him, and he died a week after that. But he was thinking of me, and he was just a super nice guy. I have to tell you one other quick story about him. I know I'm taking up a little bit of time, but when I first went to visit him, he was taking me on a tour of Bishop Gadsden, where his retirement home was. We came up to this water fountain, and it said the water there was treated by reverse osmosis, or filtered by reverse osmosis. And this little old lady who was a resident who didn't know him, and he, like I said, he was probably one of the 30 most premier biomedical scientists in the world. But this little old lady comes up and gets a cup of that water there and goes up to him, not knowing who he is, and says, "Have you ever tried this deionized water here by reverse osmosis? It's really good." And then she looked up at him and says, "Do you know what reverse osmosis is?" Here he is, like I said, one of the most premier scientists in the world. He said, "I'm somewhat familiar with it." But anyway, he was just a great friend. And what you probably want to know what he won the Nobel Prize for. It was the greatest discovery in the history of cardiovascular medicine, according to the president of the American Heart Association. But it was a side effect that he discovered that was claimed more fame than anything else. Pfizer Pharmaceuticals picked up on a side effect that he reported from this, spent a number of years, and developed the hottest selling drug that ever hit the market. And that is my presentation, so I hope you enjoy it.
So when Robert first got won the Nobel Prize, the Orangeburg newspaper had the headline, "Former Orangeburg Football Star Wins Nobel Prize."
Retta, that's exactly the story I was going to tell.
Oh, you were?
Because shortly thereafter, I interviewed Dr. Furstadt for the Jewish Heritage Collection, and he showed me that article, and he said, "That's a lie. I was not a football star." It was the only game he played in.
Let me add one story to that. The star player of that game was C.J. Abnabnett, who went on to star at Clemson later on. He threw a punch at one of the opposing Rock Hill players and was promptly ejected from the game. Robert Furstadt weighed about 140, 145 pounds, and the coach pointed to him on the bench to come in and take the star's place as a lineman at 145 pounds.
Anyway, yeah. Well, some folks had a very long trip back, and that's why we put Dr. Atkinson first. But just asking, is Dr. Lowell Greenbaum in the audience? No. Okay. We had another very good friend of Dr. Furstadt's who said he was going to come from Augusta, but he apparently didn't make it. So what I'd like to do, because we have lots of wonderful stories sitting up here, is starting with Ernie, ask each of the panelists just to introduce him or herself, describe where you grew up and what brought your family here. And this is for you too, Becky. Becky called me before the panel and said, "Just need to tell you, know I'm not Jewish, don't you?" And I said, "Yes." But really, we're interested in the interaction between the Jewish community here and the non-Jewish community. So you're our Shabbos goy. And then if you'll limit your remarks to no more than 5 minutes, you can keep it shorter than that if you like. Once we've gone down the line, I'll ask you a few questions, and then we'll ask the audience to pitch in as well. And as you know from the title, this is called Midland's Memories, Patches on a Fading Quilt. And that's kind of our theme. We're in an area of the state where Jewish life is hanging on, but not by much more than a thread. So, Ernie.
I am Ernie Marcus, and I grew up in Utahville. My grandfather, Morris Marcus, came right at the turn of the 20th century. He was from Lithuania. Some other brothers were in King Street. There's also a Marcus family there. And then there was my grandmother was Janie Cohen, and you'll hear a lot more about them for the next two or three people, actually along this line. We're all related to this line of Cohens. My father was born in 1908, but his father, Morris, died in 1917. So the store was taken over by my grandmother, Janie, and she ran it all the way until she passed away in the 1960s. And my father, other than going away for a few years to New York during the Depression and during World War II, was right there in Utahville helping to run the store, which he continued to do so until 1983, I believe, or 84. And he was also the mayor of Utahville for 23 years, and I've mentioned this before. And I lived there until college, and I went to South Carolina for a couple of years, and then went to D.C., and that never came back. Anyway, that's enough. Ronnie?
Well, my name is Ronald Cohn, and you can tell from my accent that it's not Southern. I was born in New York City. My mother was from Utahville, South Carolina. She was one of eight siblings, the Cohns over there. She went ahead and met my father and moved to New York. And as a child, they used to either pick me up and take me down, or they would put me on a train and I'd get off in Florence, and they would meet me and take me to Utahville. And to me, it was like stepping into another world. In New York, there was a lot of prejudice, a lot of anti-Semitism. We had a place at the German American Bund about two or three places from our house. You had Father Coughlin ranting over the radio anti-Semitic sayings. Our front door was a strong front door, and I found out why. Because we used to have anti-Semites a couple times come there banging on the door, hollering, "Kike, open up." I would come to South Carolina, it was like a different world. Everybody in New York said, "Oh, there's terrible anti-Semitism in the South." And I'd come here and I wouldn't find any. It was practically free. One or two cases where I found a little bit, nothing was said, but you could sort of sense it sometimes when you can feel people are not exactly friendly. But you didn't feel that in the South. We went to the schools, we played, we went to Holly Hill once a week to the movies, we went to visit the Kalinskis in Holly Hill. It was a friendly, open place. No, the front door was never locked. You just walked in and that was the way it was. You didn't worry about people coming in to break in, hollering, "Kike, open up." That only occurred up north. And it's a shame because the reputation up north is the anti-Semitism is all in the South. And there's none up here. And actually, I found as a child the reverse. Thank you.
My name is Blanche Cohen. I never lived in Utahville, but my father was the youngest of eight Cohen in the family from Utahville. And I grew up in Charleston. My father met, my mother was from Savannah. But all of my Sundays were spent in Utahville with Daddy's sisters and his family. And this was just the most wonderful gift that a child could have, because you grew up with that feeling of love, security, and belonging from his family in Utahville. It was always room for more people at the table. There was always more food on the table than you could count on. And there was a lot of area to sleep. When the cousins would come there, we would just sleep on the floor, but it was being together that made the difference. And it was a wonderful thing, and I never lived there, but I have such wonderful, warm memories of Utahville. It's a great little place.
Becky.
I'm Becky Ulmer from St. Matthew's, and I helped talk to Ernie first, and we have a wonderful museum in Ellery, and we had one exhibit that was dedicated to the Jewish families that had done so much for our town. So Ernie came up to talk to me and found out I was from St. Matthew's, so I started gathering what I remembered about the families in St. Matthew's. And then I got to a telephone acquaintance with Dale. And when I got the letter, when she asked me to be on the panel, I said, "Well, I don't know what I have to offer, you know." And so when I got the letter and a copy of some of the questions and things, I called. I said, "Dale, you do know I'm not Jewish, don't you?" She said, "Yeah," but she wanted to get kind of an idea of what it was like for us on the other side. But to me, growing up in St. Matthew's, there was no prejudice at all. Nobody thought of anybody as being different in any way. You were either a Methodist, you were Baptist, or you were Jewish, and that was it. And everybody just worked together. Most of our nice stores were run by the Jewish people in town. And I want to tell you that this was the baddest little Jewish party in town. And there was all kind of connection between some of my older cousins. Unfortunately, I was nobody's age. The Jewish kids, somehow or another, were not my age. Brenda's younger than
a
I am.
A little bit younger.
Urban's younger than I am. But my older cousins, they had lots of Jewish friends who were their age. And Steve's father dated my dad's first cousin when they were in high school. And then I had another cousin say, you know, "Well, oh, we went to all the parties and things together," and he named one of the Jewish girls in town, said, "She's the one that got me through college," and said later on she roomed with my future wife at college. So there was no prejudice to anything except when Irving was bad and had to be thrown out the swimming pool or something. But can I tell that story about...
Oh, you have to tell the story about the baptism.
May I tell that?
Yeah, sure.
This is my favorite story. It was my dad's favorite story. My dad was one of seven children. There were six boys in the family. They lived right across the street from Irving's daddy's family. The Coens lived right across the street from the Rileys. And grandmother's boys were really bad, so instead of taking them to the church to be christened, she decided it would be easier to have the minister come to her house. So she didn't want to get the children all riled up, so she just let them play in the yard until the minister got there. And they were in their little ragged clothes and all. But the little boys across the street, the little Jewish boys, were always over there playing. So when the minister got there, he lined them up. And Irving thinks it was his dad. I think it's one of his uncles. But anyhow, one of the little boys was over there, and he thought it was a game, so he wanted to get in the line. And they tried to talk him out of it, and no, he wanted to get in that line with everybody. So the minister said, well, you know, it won't mean anything to him anyhow, you know, just let him get in, and he'll be okay. And so he got in line and got christened and everything, and they said, when Chloe, his mother, found out, said, oh, it was a to-do, it was really horrible that they had christened him. They continue to be good neighbors. But that's one of my favorite stories.
I think I can clarify who it was. It was Marty Cohen.
Marty?
He told me that story.
Well, oh, Daddy told me it was Marty too, but
okay.
But you just, I am confused.
Marty said it was Marty.
Yeah.
And he said that the lady of the house said to whoever was there, don't worry, a little water won't hurt him.
But thank you for including me today.
We're delighted to have you.
Well, I'm Irving Cohen, and I'm from St. Matthew's, and I just met several of my cousins that I didn't know. I grew up in St. Matthew's, had a fantastic life, couldn't have had any better life. My parents were in the clothing business. I ended up in the furniture business, but it was just unbelievable. They could make a movie about my period growing up in St. Matthew's. Everything was just as nice as it could be. I even went to the First Baptist Church Sunday School. You know, all my friends went there. And we had our Sunday school teacher play professional football. So that was our big thing on Sunday morning, was to go listen to Knowlton Hildebrand talk about pro football. So, but life in St. Matthew's was just unbelievable. It was great.
I'm Steve Savitz. My father, Sam's from St. Matthew's, along with, there were eight in his family, eight siblings, six brothers and two sisters. His, just to sort of, I assume Cohen's was the department store.
Yeah, right next door.
Right next door to Savage department store. There was also Yellman's department store. Is there a Yellman? There's supposed to be a Yellman.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay, right. Yellman's department. You can tell the real story about St. Matthew. Real story about St. Matthew. And there was another Jewish department store, wasn't there?
There were a couple more.
Okay, yeah. And then,
Lynette's had a gun store.
And Murray Lynette was my uncle. He was married to Sarah Savitz. He was a lawyer in...
He's from up north.
From New Jersey. He went to Rutgers. He married Sarah and moved to South Carolina, never took the South Carolina bar. He had a real estate company, an insurance company, but mainly he had a dime store, what I knew, because he had all this candy. He could come and get all the free candy out of there, but he sold everything in the...
I worked for him when I was in high school.
Oh, you did?
I ate a lot of that candy.
So did I.
So did you?
Yeah, oh yeah.
But it was Franklin's Fine and Dime? It was a great Fine and Dime store. So there was, all that family was there. The start of it, though, but I didn't live in St. Matthew. My father and Morty Cohen were absolute best friends all their life growing up. Morty went to pharmacy school because my dad went to pharmacy school at South Carolina. And then they remained friends, and Dutch and my mother, essentially all their lives. But to go back to the story you're talking about, the Baptist church there, when my father died in the early 90s, he got the nicest card from men his age from the First Baptist Church in St. Matthew's, condolence card that was sent to the family from people all those years later, condolences for that. But just a little bit of history, and Peter Savitz was hopefully going to be here, who did grow up in St. Matthew's, and Susan, but both of them, one of them's going to Bar Mitzvah in New York, and the other one, who lives in Atlanta, is going to, Peter, who's in Atlanta, is going to, had something in Atlanta this weekend that he couldn't come, so here I am telling him. But Ernie did talk to Peter and got the story that was written up in the book, so that's what the history's going to be, but I'm going to tell you a little bit of history that it's a little bit different from here, some of the dates, but nevertheless, I think the dates I've got are right, even though this is what Peter said is what's in the book. But my grandmother was Ida Reed. Anybody who's from Charleston knows the Reeds in Charleston. She was born in 1877 in Latvia. They didn't ever want to say Russia. My father, my grandfather, Solomon Savitz, was born in 1875 in Davinsk, Latvia. He and Ida got married. They arrived, this says 1904, I think more accurately it was 1910, because my grandmother was pregnant with Sarah Savitz, Lynette, when they came over here, and they already had three, a boy, they had Joe, they had Sephra, and they had Abe, who died at age 7 in St. Matthew's after they had come over here, something around that time. Either had to do with a bicycle or a train or both. Nobody seems to know exactly why he died as a child. But they came to Charleston, South Carolina, because Ida's brother was Joseph Reed. And her sister was Esther Reed Dumas. And that's why they came to Charleston, South Carolina. Then, in this part, he met somebody either in Charleston or while they were in St. Matthew's who owned a store in St. Matthew's. It was a general store. And my grandfather bought the store on a handshake, which we, all the family agrees, we'll just let that yonker stay wherever it is. All the family agreed. They bought it on a handshake, took the train, because there was a direct train here to St. Matthew's from Charleston. They came up, the whole family came up on the train and spent the first night in the store in St. Matthew's. And it was a general store. It's not in the location where Savitz's was for most of those 95 years or whatever it was until it closed. But then they later moved to where the store was. And they grew up in St. Matthew's. There's a picture in, let's see if there's anything else about that. There's a picture, you know, in this book of four of the Savitz boys, my father and Isaac, who were twins, and Morris and Dan, who were the four youngest. Joe had already left, and Abe had died. But they came over, and one of the things is my grandfather did have, and you probably knew my grandfather. I didn't know him. He died in 1946, and I was born in 1947. But one of the stories that his family stories is told is during that era, of course, they left Russia, which he called Latvia, because of the pogroms that were so terrible during that time. And by the time he got to St. Matthew's, he said, "We will never speak Russian in this house. We will speak English." And I think they spoke Yiddish and other languages, because I think they spoke a number of languages, but no Russian will be spoken in this house, because he just couldn't stand the Tsar and how bad the pogroms had been in Latvia, which was then was Russia, but not to him, though. But during that time was, of course, the KKK was a pretty significant force in this era, in this area. And there was a time, at least one, where there was a KKK march right down the street where all these stores, all these Jewish stores were, right down the street, all wearing their white sheets and everything. And he came out and locked the store, standing at the street. As they're walking by, and of course the family story is that he knew all the people because he knew what shoes he had sold. So he knew who they were who were walking past the store, and they didn't do any damage to any of the businesses, I don't believe, in town, including him. One of the people said, "Hello, Mr. Savitz," as he walked by the store. But it was I never heard of any growing up from any of the family members of any prejudice either against Jews. I mean, they really were just so well accepted, in St. Matthew, South Carolina. Growing up before this particular era, when I was younger, there were so many people, and we heard this yesterday in Columbia, those of you in Columbia, who would stop me when they found out who I was, say, "Well, you related to the Savitz department store in St. Matthews." I say, "Yes," and many black people. And they say, "Well, your grandfather's the most wonderful person," said, "I worked for him. He was so wonderful to all of us, to all the both black and white community. He had them, he hired them to work. They actually served as clerks. They waited on both white people and black people. In the store, which was almost unheard of, and maybe even against the law at that time. But I had so many of that generation that stopped and told me that I didn't have to hear that just from family members. Now, the next generation, even though I know their parents and grandparents or knew them, they don't really know that story. But I had heard that in the past. And then I know I'm going way over my 5 minutes and I didn't even grow up there. But I did bring, this is Solomon Savitz. It was my grandfather who was, I don't know when this picture would have been taken. Did you remember?
I vaguely remember.
Right, that would have been younger.
I vaguely remember.
And that's a picture of Solomon Savitz. And then, and interesting that you would have told that story about football. This is my father in about 1931 or 32, because this is wearing his high school uniform at St. Matthew's High School. St. Matthew's much smaller school than Orangeburg. They may have played each other, but they would have probably got beaten pretty soundly. But there were four, in their newspaper articles, I don't have them, but there were four Savitz boys on the same football team at St. Matthew's High School at the time. So, that's enough for me. Sorry.
We'll get back to you, Steve, with some questions. Gene, do you want
to? I'm Gene Atkinson. I grew up here in Orangeburg. My main interest as far as hobbies is collecting old pictures of Orangeburg, and as you can see, some of the pictures that I had. And I've written several books on two pictorial histories of Orangeburg and one with a collection of biographies. And for the last 5 years, I've been president of the Orangeburg County Historical Society. And growing up here, there was no anti-Semitism that I could ever detect. Everybody did everything together, socially, educationally. I was well into college before I began to hear reports about anti-Semitism and so forth. Everybody did everything together here in Orangeburg growing up, and we all had a great time.
I'm Brenda Yellman Letterman, and I grew up in St. Matthews. And I think I'm a little bit younger than Irvin, but I grew up also about the same time. We came to Temple here for a little while, but mostly we drove to Columbia and went to Beth Shalom to Sunday school. I belonged to BBG there. I also worked for Marie Lynette for $5 a day, all day Saturday from like 8:30 in the morning until 6 in the afternoon, I guess, wasn't it, Becky?
I made $3.98.
But that was after taxes. $5 a day, all the candy you can eat. But I spent, when I got up in high school, junior, senior, it was a lot more fun to go to Columbia because I had then met some of the Phi Up boys at USC. So it was a lot more fun to go to Columbia, and I would take the Greyhound bus from St. Matthews to Columbia. I don't even think they have a Greyhound bus anymore. But I have beautiful memories of growing up there. My grandparents, Yuda and Hannah Yellman, ran a general store, dry goods store, right down the street from Savitz. And I remember my grandfather would give us, on Saturdays, we could go by there and he would give us a quarter and we could go, there was a movie theater just down the street, and with that quarter we could get in the movies and buy a soda. And what we had were black and white cowboy movies. Roy Rogers, Gene Autry, you name it. You could sit there all day, wanted to. Every Saturday. That's when we were smaller. And I have no memories of anti-Semitism. None. I'm still really, really good friends with some of the gals I graduated high school with 50 some odd years ago. We still get together. We still do things. And I went to BTU at the Baptist Church. I went to MYF at the Methodist Church. I don't think I missed anything. I can remember there were enough Jews there. My granddaddy brought a Torah with him from Russia when he immigrated in the early 1900s. That Torah lived here in this temple for many years. But that was after granddaddy passed away in 59. But he could get a minyan in his house in St. Matthews. There were enough Jews that he got a minyan. And that was 10 men. No women. But they would come from Eastover. Oh, I don't know where they came from. He kept chickens in the backyard. There were two separate yards. I don't know why. But he would kill chickens for whoever needed a kosher chicken. They were just wonderful people. They also would not allow Russian to be spoken in the house because they had escaped the pogroms over in Russia. They came from what is now Belarus. On another note, my grandmother Yellman was a Gordon, and so I'm Rachel's cousin. There's a lot of incestual stuff going on there. I know. So my grandmother was sister to her granddaddy Morris, and then there was Reuben, and there was my Uncle Lewis Gordon, who never married. And he was my third granddaddy, and he had a store over in Pinewood. I don't even know where Pinewood is. Orangeburg?
Sumter
County. He had a store over there, and Uncle Lewis had a blue 1956 Chevrolet, and it had the gears on the panel. You're too young. It had three gears, first, second, third. That's how I learned how to drive. But he would drive from Pinewood to St. Matthews in second gear. And I could hear him coming down the street. I can remember, Ma, there's Uncle Lewis coming down the street, because you could hear second gear coming all the way. And I think his last drive was when Daddy had to go get him out of a ditch in Creston somewhere. I got a call from the highway patrol. But my grandparents were very respected in St. Matthews. The whole town knew them. And he had customers that were black and white. I think we were raised, our parents taught us that you had to be just as kind to whoever, black, white, it didn't matter. And I think we got the same respect back. It was a good place to grow up, and I still have a lot of really good friends there. It's my second home, and I don't know, we came to Orangeburg a lot. I can remember the main street when Retta remembers it. I mean, it was a beautiful place to shop. There were all kinds of nice stores up and down the street. But I don't know. I think that's about it.
That's great, Brenda. Retta, our one Orangeburg
resident is from St. Matthew's.
Yes. Metropolis.
I know. So my grandfather's grandfather and his brother, so Lippman and Moritz Rich, were in the census in Charleston in 1855 with their wives and little children. And Lippman is listed at Brit Shalom Beth Israel, the Orthodox synagogue in Charleston. There's a picture of him and his name somewhere in the basement there. He was the treasurer of Brit Shalom in 1855. The family went to St. Matthew's. and then my grandfather, Lippman Rich, named for the great-grandfather, who was the first, not the great, he was named for his grandfather's brother, because Morris had already been named for the grandfather. So Morris Rich, who was the dentist here in Orangeburg that you remember, was named for the grandfather. So my grandfather, Lippman Rich, was named for the great-uncle. And but my grandfather was born in St. Matthew's and moved to Orangeburg as a young man, where he had the store on Russell Street. But he lost that store in the Depression. You had the picture of the store. And everybody knew him as the Metropolitan Life Insurance salesman. He was a great card player at the Elks Club and went fishing with Eddie Mermo all the time, and liked to socialize around town. My grandmother, Henrietta Block, came from Camden, and she was pretty much a homebody. She cooked for everybody and was always baking a wonderful chicken or making a cake in the kitchen. And growing up, we spent a lot of time, Carol, my sister, and I spent a lot of time at our grandparents' house. We were very, very lucky to be so close to them. Until I was in the ninth grade, we lived just around the corner on Wanamaker Street, which is a funny little street just a block down here, a little teeny crackerbock house. And my grandparents lived just down the street this way on Ellis Avenue. You passed by the school at the corner, and my grandparents lived in the house across the street from the Lutheran church. I can remember my mother and my grandmother selling cookies to raise money to build this temple. And we were forced to come here on Friday nights and miss football games. I come here on Friday nights. And I thought that Brenda was here all the time, because I remember Brenda from Sunday school. I thought you went with us here.
Sometimes.
So we had visiting rabbis. But what I was thinking about as you talked about the anti-Semitism and going to the Methodist church and the Baptist church, I did all that. I had friends that went to every church, and I went with them, and I don't remember them coming with me, but they would have, I guess, if I'd asked them, and they certainly came to my house, and we did all the things together. But I've been a tour guide in Charleston for 30-some-odd years now, and the question I get from people from all over the country is, what was it like growing up in the South? And what they don't realize what a small town I came from in the South. And I was like, it was fine. You know, it was fine. I never thought anything about being Jewish in a small town. It was just the way it was. And so finally, after so many of these questions, I asked my mother, you know, what was it like growing up in Orangeburg being Jewish? And she was like, what do you mean? You know, it was nothing. I mean, she grew up here. She had friends all her life that were her friends from childhood. Like Brenda, I still have my girlfriends that I grew up with and the guys that I grew up with, my high school reunions, and I'm just part of the crowd. And so in giving tours in Charleston, I sort of came to the realization that the dividing line was black and white. not whether you were Jewish or Methodist or Baptist or Presbyterian. And later that thought was reaffirmed by Dale, and so I was glad when Dale had the same thought that I did. But there was, and then the people coming to Charleston and taking tours with me, they think there was some kind of huge hatred between the black and white people. And there was no hatred. It was just a different world. And just a separate world. But the hatred that is assigned to us was not there. And the discrimination assigned to us was just not there. So it was a very naive world. And it was easy, and it was fun, and you know, one way to University of South Carolina and sort of never came back, except to visit many, many times. And Mom and Daddy were here until Mother passed away almost 10 years ago. And fortunately, my daddy, who some of you from Orangeburg remember, Hal Aronson, is still here, and he's at Bishop Gadsden, a very wonderful community in Charleston, where Dr. Fershcott was. So it was a good experience growing up here. It's very nostalgic coming back in here. And when and if we ever get to go downstairs to have some cookies, we will. My daddy made the tables down there. He said we shouldn't tell everybody that he made the tables. Is that enough?
That's wonderful.
Okay.
So we do have about 15 minutes before we will get to eat a cookie. But I just wanted to start, and I'm going to turn it all over to the audience because I know everyone's sitting there with a question to ask. But I was trying to think of a question that would both provoke memories of your school days, where you went to school and what that was like, but also thoughts about relations between the races, between black and white. I do believe, I have become convinced today, if not before, that there was very little, if none, no anti-Semitism. Yeah. But I think if we were, you know, had African Americans in the audience, they would not be able to be quite so cheerful about their growing up years. But anyway, here's my question, and you can turn it around and, you know, take it any way you want. But what I want to know is, what did you learn about the Civil War when you were in school?
Well, Dale, it was not the Civil War.
Oh, I'm sorry. I apologize.
All right.
The War of Northern Aggression.
It was the war between the states, and it was like it was yesterday.
Brenda, did you have the same experience?
Well, yes. And I think Retta expressed it beautifully that when we grew up, we graduated high school in 1964, which was the year of the Civil Rights Act. So when we were coming along, everything was segregated. Everything. The filling station had three restrooms, men, women, colored. That's what they all said. And the seating at the movie theater, the whites sat downstairs, the blacks sat upstairs. Everything was total, and our schools, of course. But I don't have any recollections of any hatred, animosity. There was just, we didn't, it was separate, that's all. It was just separate. And I'm sure you're right, if maybe some black person who graduated high school in 1964 might give you a different story. But we didn't have any trouble. We all got along, so I don't know.
I echo some of the sentiments and everything. You were friendly with all the blacks growing up. You knew a lot of them, and there's no hatred or anything. It's just things were separate. But you were friendly with everybody, and in some ways, there was, because of the friendliness, there was more integration from that standpoint than there is now. Because it seems like there's less friendliness now. Back then, everybody knew everybody. You'd say hello to them, and I mean, and you'd always respect people, and you were always nice, and there was none of this hatred type stuff, anything.
I found the Jews and the blacks were more interspersed in the South there were most of the black store, most of the store owners had black customers. The stores were completely segregated, especially the Jewish stores. So the result was there was a contact relationship that was there. Some of the people, like Ernie Marcus mentioned, his father owned a cotton farm, and he had black people work for him. They would build up debts, and they would go and come in on Saturday and pay off their debts, or whenever the crop came in, depending on the economic circumstances. There was a up north, they were completely separated. They were living in Harlem. You didn't have the black and white interspersed. You had some segregation in the stores and in the schools. The schools was almost universal. But the Jewish stores were really not segregated. They really had a close working relationship with the blacks. I didn't never sensed any prejudice any way, either side.
There's a lot of mutual trust back then.
Because I have a sort of different look at it. And that is, we all learn from Mary Oliphant Sims' history of South Carolina.
Yes.
And she was so much a segregationist in every sense of the word, but that's what we learned. And even though our teachers tried to, in most cases where I went to school, they tried to present to the extent that it were possible to say, well, look, some of this, you know, wasn't exactly like it said in the book. They couldn't go that far from the book. And even though in high school I had teachers that were, I thought, very liberal. This was at A.C. Floor. I graduated in 65. And very liberal. But still, we had the feeling that somehow, you know, we were the South, and some we lost the war and all this. And it wasn't until I went to the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and had a professor in American history. He was the most popular professor on campus. He came back to our 25th reunion. He was that popular. And the lecture, but all of his lectures were memorable. But he walked in the door and he said, "We won the war! We won the war! Because we're not the Confederate States of America. We are the United States of America. We won the war." It's the first time I had ever heard that. And I'm probably the first time many of you heard that, that we're in the South. That we are. I mean, we're not the Confederate States. And I think that, you know, yeah, we just sort of took things for granted. White people walked on one side of the street, black people walked on the other side of the street. And if you're white, that was fine. But if you were black, it was not fine. And it was something that gnawed on them every day. And if you just read the help and see the help, and you see...
But that movie made me angry.
Me too.
Angry.
It wasn't the way it was in South Carolina.
No.
That we did not, by law, I mean, mm-hmm. In South Carolina, we tried to keep peace. We didn't have... You know, we didn't have...
But we shared the sidewalks in St. Matthews.
Well, it was... but they had to show you deference in St. Matthews. They had to show you deference in Walterboro. They had to show you deference. And even if you were a child and they were an adult. And even though it worked out nicely and everybody got along, I mean, all this that has come out today is 100 years of things that were... My senior thesis in college was on the Constitutional Convention of 1895 in South Carolina, where everything changed. The beginning of Jim Crow and all this stuff that happened. And yes, everything was fine unless you were black.
Yeah. What this reminds me of, Sammy Davis Jr. was a very famous actor. He went to a hotel in Nevada and he swam in the pool. And after he left the pool, the prejudice was so strong and he was so upset, they drained the pool and refilled it. This was a very famous story in those days. A strong illustration of the prejudice. As a matter of fact, he became Jewish on account of that, in part.
I totally agree with Steve. It was like I said, we were so naive. Everything was fine unless you were black, but we didn't know that until later when we learned it as adults.
I was raised in downtown Charleston in the old city. And I didn't mention it before. I was a coin before I married a coin. Okay, so I thought that might be confusing. I grew up at went to Leminster High, all girls school. And I graduated in 1946. And till this day, my alumni group, we meet once a month and have lunch once a month. I call them, whatever's agreeable to them, and we go on. This was very few Jewish girls, but a smorgasbord of people, you know, a little bit of everything. There was never a problem. I have never encountered any type of discrimination in my life. And I lived around the corner from the cathedral on Broad Street, and I've gone there many times, talked to the sisters and with different people, even Christmas Eve, midnight mass, I wanted to see what it was like, so I went there. But never had I had any problem. As far as the blacks were concerned, highly respected. They loved the people because they were treated well. Nobody looked down upon them. There was just never any problem at all. We got along and we respected each other. And that was the Southern way of doing things.
Gene, have you read Gus Stetson's book?
I read parts of it, the early part of it. I was a contributor to that, but they didn't use any of my pictures after all that.
Well, I think Steve, he brought up some things in that book about the same idea of the blacks weren't as happy as we thought they were, and it was kind of a miserable upbringing maybe for them, but we were so naive we didn't realize it.
Well, when you look at Cogburn's restaurant in Columbia, which somebody talked about yesterday, all of us could go into Cogburn's and we could eat a steak or whatever, but if you were black, you had to go to the window in the back and have takeout. You weren't allowed in the restaurant. Mm-hmm. If you wanted to go, as we all know, if you wanted to go to any of the stores that had luncheonettes, a black person could stand up and take something out. They couldn't sit down anywhere. The whole civil rights movement started over a lot of that type of stuff. I mean, just stuff we didn't, as Rev said, we didn't know. We just accepted it because it was the way things had been. But we were on this side. And fortunately, there wasn't. I mean, we were very fortunate in South Carolina, as Richard talked about yesterday, our Constitution, written by John Locke, there just wasn't a history of much anti-Semitism.
And on the other hand, I know that the prejudice was going on, and we didn't know it was prejudice.
Right.
But my grandmother had blacks that lived on her farm, blacks worked for my dad, for my mama, and we were taught to look out for them. It was like they were a member of your family. If they got any kind of trouble, if they needed medicine, if they couldn't pay bills and everything, you took care of them just like they were your family. And I know it was wrong, but still, you didn't hate them or anything.
No, it wasn't that. It was just that plantation mentality that we had to take care of them instead of letting them be adults and take care of themselves.
They were not
I never felt any antagonism from them until after we had the integration. That, like somebody else brought that up. That's when I began to feel it. Before that, it was just, you live over here, I live over there.
I think
in small groups or one-on-one, there's a lot of friendliness.
Right.
But then you get the discrimination as far as public accommodations.
Yeah.
Right.
The issue is that equality. You know, if you're black, how could you feel equal to your white neighbors? No way. So I agree that there was a get-along quality of it, and I know I didn't recognize when I was standing in line this way to go to a movie theater and I see blacks on the other side of the ticket taker going up the other side, you know, being given tickets by the same ticket taker. It was like that's the way it was. It's incredible to me now to say that.
In St. Matthews, we had a theater that had a balcony. And the blacks went up in the balcony and the whites stayed down on the bottom.
Yeah.
Well, I went up in the balcony with blacks because you could see the pictures of them.
See, the difference was whites could go up in the balcony.
Right.
Blacks couldn't go downstairs.
Right.
That was the difference.
Yeah.
And we accept, you know, it was fine for us, and but they knew that. And I know in Walterboro, which where my mother was from, I'd go down there and I had a babysitter, and we'd go to the movie theater there, and oh, this is so great. I get to sit in the balcony, you know, because she couldn't sit downstairs. Even though she was with a white child, she still couldn't sit downstairs. But whites could sit whenever they wanted to. They could sit in front of the bus. Some places, in other parts of the country, I think you could sit at the back of the bus. I think in South Carolina, it didn't matter. Whites could sit anywhere they wanted to.
Remind me of another Sammy Davis story. Sammy Davis went on a bus, and he sat down. And the bus driver said, "Blacks sit in the rear. No blacks up front." Sammy Davis said, "But I'm Jewish." He said, "Get off this bus."
But Irvin remembers that KKK rally. Would you tell me?
Yeah,
you just told
I was
me?
There.
Mm-hmm.
I
you
remember
were there?
That. That was on a Saturday night, probably 9 o'clock, and they came through town. And all the stores were open. In St. Matthew's, the stores stayed open on Saturday night till like 12 o'clock. And they came through blowing the horns. And in St. Matthew's, on Saturday, you couldn't walk down the sidewalks because there were so many people. The sheriff had to walk with a billy club, swinging the club, making the black people get off the sidewalks, where white people could walk down the sidewalks. And it was crowded with people. When the KKK came through, I'd say 5 minutes later, the store was closed up because everybody was gone. You know, everybody left. I remember that.
Where was the KKK going?
They would just ride through towns.
Yeah.
They came through
blowing
St. Matthew's
the horns
a
and
lot
you could
of
see
times.
Them in the
you
sheets.
Just,
yeah.
You're young enough, you might remember one of the last ones, but they came periodically.
I got the idea that it happened periodically.
Yeah, it was periodically. But can I ask a question? Do you think that Jewish people are a little bit more tuned to prejudice and because you think that you might be more tuned to it than I would be because I never felt it. But it's a history in your race that you may have felt it. Would that be a good observance?
Well, we always knew we were different, always.
Yes.
Because we were one of the few people in town who didn't have a Christmas tree. And everybody else's house would be totally decorated. And I had a hard time recognizing why Santa would not come down our chimney, because how's he going to know that my roof is Jewish? So we had to put out milk and cookies for a while, just for me.
Bless.
I'm Les Bergen. I grew up in Charlotte, and my father was a manufacturer's rep that sold to many of your stores, men's clothing and dry goods stores in the small towns all around here. And so we have a little bit different perspective. He noted two summers I drove him around when I was 16, 17, and to these towns. And he pointed out that the Jewish men's clothing and dry goods stores tended to be more profitable, more successful than the non-Jewish. And a big part of it is what y'all are talking about, of Mr. and Mrs. to the African-American customers, maybe hiring an African-American salesperson. And the Christian stores in these small towns would not do that. And the African-Americans, which was over, you know, half the public who was buying would go to Jewish stores, and it did matter. Just the where you talk about the respect you showed was not typical in the other stores. That's why you got the business.
I want to just ask one more thing. I noticed that no one here on the panel has mentioned the incident at SC State that later became known as the Orangeburg Massacre.
I was there.
You were there?
Yeah.
I was going to ask if anybody was here at that time.
No, I was there the whole time. I was in National Guard at that time, and I was attached to the Highway Patrol. So
What are your memories of that?
Which part?
Any part. Starting with the bowling alley.
Okay. I got a phone call probably about 10 o'clock one night telling us that we were going to be activated to get to the armory as soon as possible. So I lived right here in town at that time. So we got dressed, got in a hurry, got down there. And then we found out that there was a sit-in at the bowling alley, and we were attached to go to the bowling alley. And we had to pull a perimeter around the bowling alley, and we stayed there. And then we got relieved, but we never did get to go home. We went back to the armory, and we were there, I think, probably 5, 6, 7 days. But there's a big discrepancy about the night they got shot. When I was with the Highway Patrol, there was like 10 or 15 other National Guardsmen led also, along with the Highway Patrol. We saw Molotov cocktails coming over from the college, throwing toward the railroad tracks. And then we heard there was something on the radio, on one of the Highway Patrol radio, about there was a colonel or something that was pinned down behind a building because somebody was getting shot at. You know, the shots were coming from the college to there's a long warehouse there. I can't remember the name of the warehouse.
Livingston's warehouse.
Who?
W.A. Livingston's warehouse.
W.A. Livingston's warehouse. And then all of a sudden it exploded, you know, for about 10 seconds. And it was over with. And everybody claimed that the college, they weren't shooting over at the Highway Patrol and the National Guardsmen that were in front of the college. But about a month later, the warehouse burnt down. You know, so I believe they burnt the warehouse down because there were bullets in the wood, you know, so.
I've got a great article I'll send you. I'll copy it and send it to you about that from the newspaper.
Mm-hmm. I was going to Wade Hampton Academy. I was born in 56, so it was after integration started at Utah Elementary. Instead of going through with integration, they just closed the school down. And then we started going to Wade Hampton here in Orangeburg. It's about 35 miles away. And we would always go right by SC State and Claflin to go over to the school. But there were reports, true or not, that bricks were being thrown through cars that had Wade Hampton Academy stickers. So we went a roundabout way to go to school. That's all I remember about it. So, wasn't any repercussions among customers coming in the store or saying anything.
Mm-hmm. Carla Marcus Cotty, who is not here today, is the daughter of Milton Marcus, who closed his store in 1996. I think we all heard he was the last Jewish merchant on Russell Street. But Carla told me that in the aftermath of the massacre, as it's known today, the black people were supposed to boycott all the white-owned stores on Russell Street. And her and the African-American customers were therefore afraid to come into the store to get what they needed. And so they would call her daddy, Milton Marcus. You know, if they needed a suit or something, they would call him and he would get what they needed and he would meet them somewhere and give them the suit or the shirt or whatever it was that they needed. So he was servicing his African-American customers when they weren't supposed to be shopping with him. They were shopping with him anyway, which is...
Then he came through the back door,
you know,
and made
it
the back door,
yeah.
Slip
them
out.
Last question,
see.
Bill.
There's an amazing Jewish family in a neighboring town. I think that some people are not aware of. I'm talking about the Bass family in North. I think they had about
He was a merchant. I think he had six or seven children. One was killed as an aviator over Europe during World War II. Talking about the Orangeburg Massacre, Jack Bass wrote two books published on that subject. He's a well-known writer taught at College Charleston. He published several books on Southern history. Ruth Bass Jacobs in Charleston was quite involved in Jewish community, but she had one son, Herbie, who published two books, and it's just, I'm not naming all the children, but all of them had some prominence. Oh, Marsha Bass was interviewed on the Bill Cosby show. And when Bill Cosby was on the Johnny Carson show several years later, he brought a video of that clip, said, "This is the funniest thing I've ever seen on my show." And when Johnny Carson saw, he couldn't stop laughing. I think this video I can get probably lasts about 5 minutes, but I think it'd be very entertaining.
I've seen it so many times. It's on YouTube.
Yeah.
Yeah. She said, yeah.
I think more than 100,000 hits.
I know.
It's
Bill Cosby's show. What was the name of his show?
What's on the video?
He asked her where she's from, and she says, North South Carolina. And it proceeded into like this 5-minute dissertation about.
I got you.
Yeah. North South Carolina is 18 miles from due west.
One other name that's not related, and then we. But how many people here knew Hannah Pearlstein?
She's from St. Matthew's.
She's from St. Matthew's. My father said, and of course she was a teacher. She lived to be 105 or something. But he said she's the one, and of course. Our family all came to Tree of Life. I mean, all the Savices, Lynettes, and all went to Tree of Life. But when he was growing up in St. Matthew's, he said she's the one that taught Judaism to all the Jews in St. Matthew's. It was Hannah Pearlstein. Mm-hmm. So, going back to.
If I could just add some words about current Temple Sinai. I moved here in 81. And Lillian Goldberg was a neighbor. Morty Rubenstein used to run services when I first came here. It took a few years before we started coming, but I had young kids and they were welcomed here. And the membership was very small. Most of the kids grew up and left town. My kids are now out of Orangeburg and will not return either. But they do have some good memories of coming to Temple here. They do remember that. My son was the one he was referring to at last, got bar mitzvah, and we filled up the place, really. About 20% was my family. Another 10% might have been membership, and the other 70% were his friends and their family that came and were invited. And when we had Hanukkah celebrations, it was maybe 10% Jewish because my kids would invite their friends. So we tried to keep things going to an extent. And that's really our purpose now. In the roughly 30 years I've been a member, our membership has gone up and down. And the hope is that enough Jewish people will come in and be interested to actually join the temple. Now, we have never had a rabbi, as you said. We've had some generous donations. We often were funded by the Miller Foundation, but that comes and goes, I guess, depending on their board. Even though there's a plaque up here recognizing his contribution. So we're teetering, but we hope to maintain. And you can see the building is fairly well maintained, even though our membership is very small and our dues probably just barely cover utilities, not major expenses or other things that we have. But we have been fortunate to maintain. The main problem with increasing our membership is if you really move to Orangeburg and you're religious, we don't have a rabbi, you've got to go to Columbia or Charleston. And, you know, but the group that's here is like family, very tight, mm-hmm. have been around. We do run, like we said, we run services once a month because, frankly, when Morty died, the synagogue was not utilized. No one took over. And after the Yom Kippur services, his widow declared that it was time to sell. And a couple of families stood up and said, no, we'll run services, but we'll start doing them once a month. And we maintained that. And we have. And we've had people join and have enjoyed the experience. But yes, if you're religious, you probably need to run the Charles Center Point.
Well, I think on behalf of all of us, we really want to thank you for welcoming us here this afternoon. And I really want to thank our panelists. I mean, I enjoyed listening. I think we got wonderful stories on tape. And there is a lovely on egg. I'm going to hang on to these guys for a minute to get them to sign interview agreements, but please go downstairs. They'll be down in a second, and you can ask them some more questions.